Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome to another episode of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. My name is Virginia, and with me tonight is Andrew Gillis.
How are you doing, Virginia?
I'm doing great, thanks. This episode's topic will be the creatures of the Shan Chan, which are sometimes referred to as exotics, especially by the Big White Book. Before we get started with our topic, we have a little news from the world of the Wheel of Time. And so here, without further ado, is what you should know. The biggest thing on our schedule coming up is JordanCon, which is a convention devoted to the works of Robert Jordan. It is going to be held in Alpharetta, Georgia, a suburb of Atlanta, April 17th through the 19th. Pre-registration is $60. You can find all of the information that you need at ageoflegends.net. There will be special guests and a lot of special activities. Probably the most special guest will be Harriet McDougall, who is wife of the late Jim Rigney, who is best known, of course, as Robert Jordan. Also, Wilson Grooms. You may remember Wilson as the fellow who updated RJ's blog when he couldn't do it. He describes himself as brother cousin fourth of three because he was so close to the family. He might as well have been a brother. And arguably one of the other greatest guests there will be Brandon Sanderson, who has been tapped to finish A Memory of Life for Robert Jordan. There will also be presentations by the Dabble Brothers. There will be various other exciting things, including my favorite, a Shan Chan Hold'em charity tournament. So those poker fans out there, sign up for that one. Some of us are going to try to be there from the Fourth Age podcast. We're not definite yet, but we're going to make every effort. So we hope that we'll see you there. Our second big piece of news is the announcement of a contest, which is taking place on tarvalon.net. Melissa Crabb, in conjunction with Brendan Sanderson, has started a two-part contest. All fans who donate will be given a chance to be in the book In Memory of Light as part of a unique combat unit that Brandon Sanderson is going to create, which is going to be participating in the last battle. This unit will represent all the fans who donated to the cause to fight poverty in our own world. So when you read about them in the final book, you'll know they represent you. So you can also vote with a poll to vote for the type of fighters that you would like this to be. Several donors, however, will get a more personal reference. The highest bidder in the silent auction will be memorialized as a character, physical description, and name within Wheel of Time guidelines in A Memory of Light. Those who participate in the general fund name will have their names entered into a drawing. At least two donors will be selected and memorialized as officers of the unique combat unit, representing all who participated, with a minimum of $20 donation to be eligible for this drawing. So you can participate either in the general fundraiser or in the silent auction. And the last time I checked, the silent auction for having your own character name and likeness in the Wheel of Time was about $5,000. So if you've got deep pockets, please donate to that. All the money goes to charity. It's for a very worthy cause, Heifer International, and we hope that we'll all be a part of that.
Now, obviously, since our topic is the Shan Chan creatures, I first would like to say that because they first appear in the second book, but they appear throughout the almost entirety of the series, if you have not read very far into the series, there are going to be spoilers in this episode. And if you do not want the plot spoiled for you, you might want to tune out about now, because we'll be discussing creatures that have a profound effect beginning in Book 2 and all the way up as far as we have read in Book 11.
That's right, and I'm sure they'll probably be a major factor in A Memory of Light as well. So we hope that, if that's true, that you will come back to our podcast episodes once you have gone through the entire series, and hopefully you'll enjoy our conversation. Andrew, would you like to start us off with a creature, your favorite one, perhaps?
Well, I'm not exactly certain they're my favorite, but I have always had a fondness for the very first Shan Chan creature that we
ever met before we even knew that they were connected to the Seanchan. As a matter of fact, when we first see them, I'm not certain that we even know the Seanchan exist yet. And that would be the Grom. They are large, bear-sized, three-eyed, beaked, frog-like creatures. And we see them in a alternate reality that Rand has accidentally taken himself, the sniffer Huron, Loyal, and unbeknownst to him at first in that Landfear, disguised as Selene.
Well, that's right. That was in the Great Hunt. Yeah, that was one of the worlds reached by portal stones, I think, were the ones that they called Mirror Worlds or something like that. There was a book called Mirrors of the Wheel that talked about it. I know Selene, she called herself Selene, Landfear did, and told Rand about this book. And the Grom seemed to appear mysteriously when Landfear did, and I'm assuming that she probably summoned them somehow. And she basically kind of got together with Rand by setting it up so that he would rescue her from a Grom that was threatening her.
Yeah, and she's the one who points out really quickly. It's one of the first indications that she's more than what she appears, because she seems to have all this inside information about the creatures, how their hides are really thick and conventional means of attacking them aren't going to do much good. According to the Big White Book, Grom hides are thick enough to turn most blows from swords, axes, or spears. Arrows even fail to penetrate those hides unless aimed at a vulnerable spot. And it was Selene at the time who, you know, says, you know, the only way you'd be able to kill those with the bow would be to hit it in one of the eyes. And of course, Rand summoning the void, which is then, you know, the void and the flame, you know, manages to pluck out, kill like two or three of them really quickly, just center eye every single time. And I always liked that scene because it's just, you know, Rand calmly drawing the bow, and once again, the Two Rivers longbow just seems to totally rule sometimes on the battlefield.
Yeah, I kind of wish I had one myself, although I probably couldn't draw it if I did. But I love that scene where Selene first appears. She's fending off this Grom with a stick, and then Rand comes riding up to the rescue, followed by a huffing and puffing Huron and Loyal, and she calmly tells him, "You must shoot it in the eye," you know, and just acts like it's no big thing whatsoever. You know, it's really, she gave a lot of clues to the fact that she was a little more than, you know, she appeared to be at the first. And but those Grom, they're pretty spooky looking. I thought those were pretty impressive when I first read the Great Hunt. I thought, wow, you know, that's an imagination for you. I wouldn't want to meet one in a dark alley, that's for sure.
Well, you know, unless the alley's pretty small, because I think one of the things that caught me more by surprise, even than, like, you know, there's this large thing, it's got, like, a horny beak, and, you know, it's got this little triangle sort of three-eyed thing going on. What was creepier was that this is something that's described as looking like a frog that is the size of a bear. And it moves like a frog, so that, like, they hop at you. And I can just imagine this, you know, something the size of a bear leaping in these gigantic frog-like hops at you. It could be terrifying.
Yeah, it would certainly set me back a little bit. But then we see them later in the Great Hunt with the advent of the Seanchan. I think Bale Doman sees them first when he's taken to the High Lord Turak's house, and he sees them out in front, and he's just astounded at that. And the Grom don't bother Padden Fain either. He's another one that saw them, and then Rand and Huron saw them later on when they go to try and enter High Lord Turak's house that he's taken over. And I don't remember exactly what they used the Grom for in battle. I think that there's some problem with them going into their frenzy, though, their feeding frenzy or their battle frenzy. That some people think that they're not as good for battle as some of the other Seanchan animals. Was it Lopar and Shredded or something? Or I can't remember now. There's so many of them.
Well, the main use of the Grom in battle is as they're used as light infantry combat, basically. If the armor of the enemy is anything heavier than like a light armor, then they have problems with it. But if they're lightly armored, the Grom can break through pretty easily. They're also used usually against cavalry, because once again, just the sheer nature of them seems to disturb horses, and because a lot of people on horseback are going to be using, you know, a spear or a longer axe or even sometimes, you know, a longer sword, their hides make it pretty easy for them to get in there and cause some major damage to the people who are on horseback. But yeah, they don't really go into the frenzy so much as if they're not completely properly trained, they're pack animals, but they're kind of, I want to say almost hyena-like. They'll get really jittery, and if, you know, one of their own falls in battle, the pack will just kind of stop and be like, ooh, food, and they'll just all, like, pounce on and they'll, like, start tearing each other apart to get at, you know, a fallen comrade. So they're kind of harder to train, which is why they aren't used exclusively in battle. They're used sometimes, but yeah, some things like Torum are a lot more frequently used when they're available.
Yeah, I could see where they'd be pretty devastating against cavalry. I can't imagine that you'd have much luck getting a horse anywhere near a Grom.
It's an interesting thing. I was just looking through the White Book, and one of the really interesting things that I've noted about a number of the Shanshan creatures is that a lot of them seem to have a high birth mortality rate. Very few of them actually have more than one or two that actually survive in a birthing litter or clutch. And it seems like, according to the book, that seems like a really fortunate thing, because, you know, it takes a lot to kill most of these creatures.
Yeah, that's for sure. It might be tough to raise a whole litter of those things. I was thinking that the Grom share that trait of attacking fallen pack members with the Dark Hounds, but I think we should probably mention at this point that even though most of the people in Rand's side of the world seem to take them for Shadow Spawn at first sight, they really aren't. I'm trying to remember now. Were they native to Shanshan originally, or Randland? I know it was discussed in one of the earlier podcasts, but I don't remember what the conclusion was, because I don't know how in the Mirror Universe the Grom appeared, you know, in the continent where Rand is, near Carrion, when in the real world there aren't any Grom except what the Shanshan later brought with them. And how'd Lanfear know all about them?
I'm thinking Lanfear knew about them because, having been one of the head researchers at the Kalom Dawn in the Age of Legends, she probably would have been amongst the people who studied the portal stones in the Mirror World. And if I remember properly, all of the creatures that the Shanshan used that were part of the once armies of the night, or whatever they were called, originally came, they were like refugee animals that were brought from other portal worlds to this particular world. And I guess for some reason a massive population of them happened to be gathered in the place that is Shanshan. And the ones that might have been in the current Rand land during the breaking, you know, must not have been able to survive very well and just kind of died off.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember them saying that Shadow Spawn couldn't survive Tramaline. It doesn't say anything about the Shanshan exotics, but since they aren't technically Shadow Spawn, then perhaps there's no trouble with that.
I don't know. I think a lot of the reason that you don't see very many of them is the fact that they do come from essentially another reality. And I think not being native to what we'll call our universe, they tend to have a harder time surviving. which makes them very valuable, and that's why the Shanshan were so keen on, well, let's not destroy these things, because even though they were being used against us in the war, we won, but they're still really, really valuable animals.
Right, especially the next one. I think one of the next animals that we see in order of chronology would have to be the Rakan, the giant flying lizard-like creatures. They're pretty fascinating, too. They seem a little bit like dragons, but it doesn't appear that anybody in Randland makes that connection, probably because they aren't that familiar with dragons in the first place. But they're pretty big. They can carry two riders, and they're used by the Shanshan to mostly to send messages and to do like advanced scouting and so forth. And then they have a larger creatures that are evidently related called the Torakan, which can carry a lot more people and evidently supplies.
Yeah. So basically, the these large bird-like creatures, both of them are bipedal creatures with wings and elongated necks and tails. So yes, once again, they do kind of have that pseudo-draconic appearance. They are very obviously, once again, somewhat reptilian looking, and it's actually possible in one of his many trips back to Tyr that Rand takes. He goes into an inn that has been named, the Dragon or something like that, and he notices that someone has taken the image of the dragon, which is on his forearm, and added like wings, and they have it like breathing fire, and basically the creation of the dragon imagery that a lot of European descendants are familiar with. And I'm not wondering if the addition of the wings, at the very least, matters, is someone who has seen or heard described, the Shanshan creatures. But getting back to the actual creatures themselves, the Rakan are pretty much your scout ships, and your Torakan are your troop transports. When you're going on the army, the Rakan are more intelligent. A handler of the Rakan, or the Morat Rakan, actually have a higher standing in the Shanshan army than the Morat Torakan. So, if even though both people, like both types of flyers, could fly either creature, for someone who exclusively works with Rakan to fly a Torakan is a major blow to their face. It's kind of that they lose status essentially by coming down to work with the Torakan, which are horribly stubborn, and if they're wounded, they won't go much further than the next safest landing spot.
Yeah, quite a come down, I guess, to have to be stuck with one of those big Torakan. I guess it's sort of like expecting a race car driver to drive a big rig. They're not going to be impressed with it too much. Certainly seem to impress anybody from Rand's side of the world when they see them. It's pretty shocking when all of these creatures, make their arrival on the scene. And I think that's, a big part of the Shanshan Army's success. They have these huge, intimidating creatures that, well, I know they're known over in Shanshan, but, there's so many of them are just difficult for the average, citizenry to try and deal with, and then that's just, to let alone the Damani. That obviously would overwhelm almost anybody who didn't have Damani of their own. Now, there's no evidence that any of these other creatures have anything to do with the power either, I suppose, that bears mentioning. Now, what other ones? Let's see, we're talking about there's Khorm. I don't know if I'm saying that right, Khorlam. Torm and the Sredet, and I always thought that the Sredet, they remind me of elephants. I'm sure that's the obvious connection that everybody makes. And I think we see those fairly early on, too, with Sarandon, don't we?
The first place that I am really aware of them is when they are picked up by Valon Luka and his grand display of marvelous wonders.
Right, and Elaine and Nynaeve take up with the menagerie, and Sarandon is the stranded Shanshan Sredet trainer, and she has three of them with her in Valon Luka's show. And they pretty much cause a melee when the carriage runs across them, and the horses see them, because horses, of course, like elephants, just they hate these things. They just see them and just freak out.
Yeah, and the bull Sreddit, kind of goes berserk and tears open the side of an inn and gets Vala and Luca's show pretty much run out of town.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the greatest things is that, I mean, very much like an elephant handler, you do get to see some really nice moments where, you know, the Sreddit are capable of moving huge burdens, and basically unlike any other of the Shanshan creatures, but at the same time they have kind of a family community thing. There's definitely a Sreddit calf amongst the three. It's a mother, a bull, and a calf, and they do the typical circus elephant, you know, tricks where they, you know, they balance themselves on each other's backs and do a number of different things that just is really neat. But then, yeah, Sarandon says, you know, a lot of people, you know, they like the Torum or the Corum for battle, but, you know, me, I really think that it's the Sreddit. And truthfully, you know, to use a different analogy, if you were looking, if any of you have seen the movies for The Lord of the Rings, you know, in the last movie, in The Return of the King, you see the Haradrim riding the Mumukile, which were essentially large versions of elephants again, used in battle. And they are just this ferocious, gigantic creature charging at you, and they tear things apart. They're just, you know, phenomenally destructive when they want to be.
Right. Those things almost remind me more of mammoths than they did elephants, but definitely the same relation. And what you mentioned about the, you know, the communal attitude of the Sreddit, I think Sarandon mentions at one point in time that Naren the calf was not Sanit's actual progeny, but they all got along just fine and everything. And she does a lot of the same things that they do with elephants too. She files their nails down with a big file, and she has a little goad that she uses to show them, you know, direct them where to go and everything. So evidently they're extremely similar to what we know as elephants in our day.
Which is, you know, fortunate, because it's the most natural of all of the Shanshan creatures when compared. I think the closest after that, even though it's really not close at all, is the Corum, which is essentially a cross between an ostrich and a kangaroo, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, but they look more bird-like, I think. The drawings that I've seen, anyway, they appear to have beaks, you know. Well, that would be ostrich-like. But they have almost a reptilian look to them, too, with the long tails. And I suppose that could be like kangaroos, too. I'm not quite sure what they do with those. I guess they're good at tracking, right? The Corum. That's a hard word to say.
Yeah, It's odd. Once again, for some reason, a lot of these Shanshan creatures seem to be a fusion of two animals. It's a large flightless bird, about 8 feet tall, but then it's covered in fur. You know, and it's just one of those weird things. They are very good at tracking, and pretty fast in short sprints, pretty much equal to man, you know, the man's ability to run over, you know, longer distances. But they tend to be solitary, and they don't like each other very much. And apparently, like, they even lay the eggs singly. They don't even, like, lay an entire clutch. So it's a really finicky creature, and I don't know that we've seen them too much. I think we've heard them mentioned a little bit, but by and large, I don't think they're used too much in military application, at least not in a widespread level.
Or possibly they just didn't transport well to this continent with the long sea voyage and everything. Perhaps they just didn't, you know, they personally wouldn't survive the journey very well if they're so finicky.
That's true. And I mean, it does say
that they don't like each other's company at all very much, except during mating time. So, I mean, it's possible that, you know, with the number of ships that the Shanshan brought over, you can only have one of them on board at a time. It just might not have been practical to bring very many of them.
Yeah, that's true. And they had the Rakan to do the scouting, but I don't know how much tracking they'd really need to do when you're doing an invading army. That's kind of an interesting thought. Looking at this picture that's on EncyclopediaWatt.com, or .org, I beg your pardon. I'm looking at this picture that's on EncyclopediaWatt.org, and with the Shanshan mounted on them with their insectile armor, they're pretty spooky looking. I'd certainly hate to have one of those tracking me, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely give the Shanshan creatures the award for just most unnerving things, I think. I mean, to an extent, I think if you have to live with them, you can get used to Trollocs. I mean, the people of Shinar don't bat an eye at a Trolloc or a Murgle. Yes, they're really unearthly, or unearthly, but there seems to be something about the Shanshan creatures that no matter how long you were, unless you were raised with them, that you just never seem to be able to get really used to seeing them, because, you know, they're, all of them are just amazingly bizarre.
They really are, and so many of them have three eyes, too, like the last ones, the Twurm. They're three-eyed, bronze-scaled, cat-like creatures the size of horses, and they're ridden like horses. But they're just weird-looking. I mean, and why do all these creatures have three eyes? I've never quite understood that. It's very interesting. And then I think, didn't Seraph have a Twurm for a guardian pet, sort of like a big guard dog? I think they described it as, I believe when Morgaze saw it for the first time, it looked like a big pile of leather, you know, mats or something in the corner, and then the thing moved and she realized it was this massive creature just laying there keeping watch over the Shanshan woman.
I do remember that. In fact, the creature it was is one we haven't mentioned yet. It is the Lopar.
Oh, the Lopar, that's
and,
right.
Yeah, and they are massive creatures weighing, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 pounds apiece. They're basically, once again, really large, bear-sized creatures, but they're mainly, yeah, used kind of like guard animals because they tend to be about the, you know, intelligence equivalent of a dog. They're intelligent enough that when they look at you, you can kind of tell what they're thinking. You know, and so they have this, what, you know, it's like a cold, malevolent gaze that they just stare at people with, you know, if they think that you might be threatening their owner. And it's kind of creepy.
Yeah, and they're supposed to be very intelligent as well. In fact, some people think that they're too intelligent to really be used properly in battle. The other odd thing about them is that they have six-toed forepaws with retractable claws. And these things are just weird. I can't even imagine having something like that as a pet. I totally forgotten that that was a Lopar that Seraph had, not a Twurm. I sort of forgot about the Lopar. And she had this Lopar named Almandaragal since she was a child, and he foiled several attempts on her life. It's like amazing. I wouldn't even attempt to go up against something that size with retractable claws and, you know, 2,000 pounds of, you know, mean, bear-like creatures. I don't think so, not unless I had a few assault weapons on me. Or the one power.
Yeah. I mean, and one of the other kind of creepy thing about the Lopar is, unlike most of the other Shanshan creatures, when they are used in battle, they actually armor these things. So it's not just like a bear on the battlefield, like a trained bear or something. This is, you know, a highly intelligent bear that is capable of, you know, bipedal or, you know, quadrupedal movement, that is wearing like a leather jerkin sewn with steel discs on it. I mean, it's an armored bear, which is even, you know, kind of creepier, because then suddenly they're ferocious, they're intelligent, and they think to actually armor these things, which they don't do with the Torum, mainly because the Torum's main advantage is their speed, really. But I mean, just it's kind of weird, and they like do, like you said, you're used primarily as bodyguards, because they tend to form attachments really easily to one person, and that way they're kind of like a giant bear-sized chow. And as creepy as that sounds.
Yeah, I guess they're very loyal too. Well, that's pretty scary. My first thought was, I hate to do crossover stuff, but my first thought when you mentioned the armored Lopar being bear-like creatures was the armored bears in Golden Compass, but probably not nearly as good-looking. I think these Lopar are pretty ugly. I can't imagine getting really chummy with any of these Shan-Chan creatures, to be honest with you. I guess it's an acquired taste. I think I'll stick with dogs myself.
Yeah, they have these, like, you know, two large dark eyes that have these kind of horned ridges around their brows. And the other weird thing about the Lopar is they have no external ears. Like, out of everything else that you can say, it's just, you know, there's this big, massive, leathery, bear-like creature with no ears and the kind of, you know, spiked brow and this brooding, you know, massive evil. I mean, not evil, but I mean, there's this massive, you know, brute force that just, you know, yeah, it'd be weird to have it anywhere, let alone, you know, sitting with you in the room at all times. And, you know, oh, look, you know, did the Lopar eat a burglar? Oh, I must have. That's all I can think of.
That would have to just be a snack for one of those things. I was just thinking how much one of those things would eat if they weigh near 2,000 pounds. I mean, you know, look how much it takes to keep a Great Dane or a Wolfhound or something in dogs. I mean, they eat a lot of food, and they're only maybe 150, 180 pounds. Maybe a Mastiff might be pushing 200, but 2,000 pounds? You'd be feeding that thing all the time. You would run out of burglars.
Oh, yeah. I was once again flipping through the white book here, and I think I found a reason why the Korom also probably weren't brought over, and that's because the Korom and the Torum have an especial dislike of each other. It says a Torum will always strike at any Korom within reach, and while a Morat can keep the attack from becoming actual combat, they're just never used together. And since the Torum were actually needed for the Shanshan Forerunners, they probably didn't bring very many, if any, Korom over, just because, you know, they needed the Torum more.
Well, they'd have to keep them on separate ships and keep them separate. I think they also keep the Rakan separate. I know, wasn't it in Altara? They had the Rakan and the Tolrakan on a separate peninsula so that they wouldn't, you know, frighten some of the other animals that they had to deal with, because it wasn't easy to train the local horses to accept the presence of these exotic animals. And I didn't mention much about the Tolrakan, but other than the fact that they're used to transport troops and equipment over large distances, but apparently they could cover nearly 200 miles in a day. And that's pretty good for that day and age. I mean, apart from traveling, nobody can really move a lot of stuff faster than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it definitely. And, I mean, once again, they're used to land massive amounts of troops. And, I mean, you think about it, you have, you know, a Torok and, you know, filled up with, you know, Saddam and Daman, and, you know, suddenly you've got, you know, the equivalent of a flying battleship, for lack of a better term. I mean, this, you know, they can land massive amounts of people, and just, you know, suddenly there's the one power, and there's, people in insectile helmets leaping out from off the back of this thing that, you know, can only be imagined in Randland as, you know, a shadow spawn, even though it really isn't. It's kind of amazing.
I'm trying to remember where I read it, but it must have been in Crossroads of Twilight or Knife of Dreams. I'm trying to remember now. Something about the Tolrakan were mostly used to land the Fists of Heaven, who were the lightly armored but really fierce advance, like shock troops, and then to bring supplies and stuff like that. I don't know if it says anywhere how many actual troops or what sort of weight they can actually carry. But evidently it must be a lot, because I know when Suroth and Tylin left on their tour of Altara, they took a whole entourage with them. They had their a lot of other members of the Blood and their servants and so forth and so on. So they must be pretty big.
According to the White Book, with one Morot up on a Tolrakan, they can carry an additional 1,000 pounds or more of cargo. So it's a fairly... they're primarily used for transporting people who must be moved quickly, or urgent cargo. So they tend to have the shock troops. But it does say that occasionally they have been loaded up with archers or crossbowmen, and used just like a weird medieval bomber a little bit.
Sort of like, not exactly a stealth bomber of the Middle Ages, but sort of like that. Yeah, 1,000 pounds, that's really only maybe, half a dozen guys with equipment, I would think. They don't really say much. Do they say much in the White Book? I didn't bring mine with me, unfortunately, today. They say much in the White Book about the Fists of Heaven in there at all?
Not really. From what the White Book usually does in this case, is talk more extensively about the physical features of the creature, and then a little bit about its general habits. When it gets into how they are used, it doesn't really go into great amounts of detail, but they do mention how they're valuable as moving massive amounts of people, and usually it's kind of quickly. Funny thing is that the Tolrakan, of course, being a larger animal, actually has a slower flying speed than the Rakan. It's still about twice the speed of a horse, and with that additional speed, it also has more endurance than a horse, which is why it can move as great a distance as it is capable of. The Rakan are capable of about 4 to 5 times the speed of a horse, which is really kind of interesting because, they can cover literally, amazing amounts of ground and be able to scout forward and back much quicker than anyone except, an Ashaman or an Aes Sedai using traveling could possibly do.
Yeah, they were definitely state-of-the-art until the advent of traveling by the Ashaman and the Aes Sedai, although it was only the Ashaman that have used it for battle so far. I think the Big White Book doesn't mention too much about the Fists of Heaven because it probably predated our first mention of them in the book, now that I think about it. And then Perrin also makes use of the Shanchen animals in his rescue plan for Fael to transport all of the Forkert tea and everything.
That's true. And I do kind of wonder, like you said, the White Book does kind of predate a lot of what has developed in the Shanchen. I'm not wondering if along the line maybe Robert Jordan changed his idea about exactly how much or like how many a Tolrakan can carry, because it seems to me that with the Fists of Heaven and that, it seems like they should be capable of carrying a lot more than what they're suggesting, or what the White Book suggests they could carry. I'm not certain. I mean, maybe Maybe it is, and maybe it's not. I don't exactly know how much the Shanshan armor weighs in relative to your standard plate mail.
Well, it's got to be less than plate mail. Good heavens. They don't really say anything about what it's made of. They just mention repeatedly that it's lacquered. And so I don't really know what it would be made of. It must be, well, I would presume it's some sort of metal. It'd have to, almost have to be decent armor, although I suppose it could be, you know, the Orientals used, I believe, bamboo and things for armor as well. Not too up on my medieval armor.
I also couldn't quite say. I've had the honor of being in leather and some small amount of plate and chain in my days with doing some historical recreation here and there. So I can tell that they do get increasingly heavy. I've never actually had the privilege of wearing any wood or bamboo type armor, so I wouldn't exactly know how much that would weigh in relation. If anybody out there actually happens to know the difference in that, go ahead and shoot us an email at some point. I'd actually kind of be curious to know.
Yeah, I've never worn any sort of armor at all, chain, plate, or any of that stuff, but all I know is that plate mail is extremely heavy. I think, you know, over 100 pounds for most people. And then, of course, back in actual medieval times, if you go and look in museums where they have, you know, suits of armor, the most amazing thing about it is that they're all small. You know, most of the, because people were smaller back in, you know, 400 or 500, 1,000 years ago. They weren't as tall. This is more of a modern phenomenon that, you know, humans have gotten to be as big as they are in these days because we have better nutrition and, you know, a lot of other things going for us that they didn't have back then. But you look at Alexander's armor or something like that, and those were small guys. I mean, it would take almost not quite a child to fit into it, but close. I mean, probably 5 foot, 5'2" maybe if you're lucky. They seem very, very tiny.
Just kind of goes to show you what beef hormone can do for your diet.
Yeah, I don't think they had too many steroids back then either, or in Randland as well. Surely Samael would have been on them if they had had those, right?
Samael using performance-enhancing drugs.
Well, he was an athlete. Wasn't he a professional athlete at one point in time?
Yeah, kind of odd to imagine.
I think those guys were so competitive that they would have done pretty much anything to get the edge over anybody else.
It makes you kind of wonder what's in the food the Aiel eat, because they're amongst the tallest of the people within the series that we meet.
I know, and from the diet that they're described as having, you know, in the waste, it seems difficult to believe that they could be, you know, they could be getting anything approaching an optimal diet in order to, you know, achieve their full genetic potential. I mean, you know, we have that in, I happen to be a person who raises show dogs, and one of the things that we have a constant problem with in many breeds is that the standards that were written 100 or 150 years ago call for a certain size of dog, and these days it's hard to keep them into that range a lot of times because we just feed our animals so much better than they did back then. And I'm pretty sure the same thing is true, you know, obviously with humans, because we all just have better medical care and better nutrition and like that. So I don't know how the Aiel could achieve their potential with just the diets that they're described as having. It seems difficult to believe, but you never know. I mean, look at the Maasai warriors in Africa. I mean, they're very tall too, and I'm sure they're not eating optimal either.
Quite possibly. I have no idea where we're going now.
Yeah, I know. We really deviated. Off topic. Well, speaking of the Age of Legends, it's one of the things that we have on our agenda is an episode on other creatures from the Wheel of Time. The many creatures that are mentioned from the Age of Legends that no longer seem to exist, as well as the Shadow Spawn and some of the genetically created creatures from the Age of Legends, like Trollocs and Murdral.
And as well, probably a rehash on the Nim, which was also a construct creature, not originally, as far as we know, indigenous to what we know as Randland, or even, you know, Age of Legends Randland.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always wonder why they're so related to the, you know, to the Ogier. Actually, we should save this for the other topic, because they seem to have something in common, but yet the Ogier are apparently a naturally occurring race of beings, or the Nim were a construct. I'm not quite sure how they did manage to go about that. I don't know where they got the genes to create the Nim.
I don't know. Definitely a good point of discussion for when we go into that particular topic. My thought, possibly also looking at how the Ogier, though not able to channel, seem capable of manipulating the source in a slight way, primarily through the tree songs.
Yeah, that's sort of interesting. It doesn't ever mention that that's an actual power-related ability, but they're definitely quite different from anything else that we see in the Wheel of Time world. I just noticed an interesting little note here in my favorite place on the web, the encyclopediawatt.org. It says that there is an Ogier Street in Charleston, South Carolina, Robert Jordan's home. How about that? I wonder where they came up with that name, Ogier.
I don't quite know. It's an interesting thing when you think about it.
Yeah, I wonder if it came about because of the Wheel of Time, or if it was somebody's name and he got that name because of running past that street all the time.
Well, the wheel weaves as the wheel wills, and many things are still a mystery to us.
That's for sure. I'm afraid that even after the last book, that many of these things are going to be a mystery to us.
Yeah, I count that as a good thing, because that'll give us more to talk about even after the last book is published.
I think that's true. We'll probably be discussing this series for a long time. Well, after all, people are still discussing Lord of the Rings, and that's really been around a long time.
Well, I think that since we have exhausted all of the Shanshan creatures that we can think of, that'll pretty much wrap up this particular episode. But we would definitely encourage anyone who has any ideas, comments, thoughts, criticisms, crazy ideas, if you've found something that we've missed, if we've completely forgotten about some poor Shanshan creature that, you know, you've really enjoyed hearing about and we just completely skipped over them, or if you have other thoughts on the particular creatures that we did mention, we've got a lot of ways you can get a hold of us. The first way would be to contact us via our voice messaging system, which is 1-888-333-7690.
And you can also email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. You can also reach us on the web at dragonmount.com in the forums, both the main forum section and off the podcast page. Each podcast that's posted will have its own comment section. And several of us, I in particular, frequent that comments page for each episode, and we've gotten into some long and involved discussions on that, and you might enjoy reading through those.
One thing that we should mention, and it gets asked a lot when people email or call us in, is where you can find earlier episodes of the podcast. After a certain period of time, iTunes no longer carries older material released by some podcasts, and as a result, it's a little difficult sometimes for people to find some of the earlier episodes. As far as I know, at least the first 13 episodes are no longer available on iTunes. You can find those at dragonmount.com. Each podcast should have its own individual download link next to it, so you can always find the older episodes there if you're looking for them.
And I believe you can still find some of the episodes, the original episodes, on our MySpace page, which is www.myspace.com/fourthage. And we're starting to keep that up again now, and I believe they do have links to most of the episodes on there. Anyway, that should pretty much wrap up this episode. I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for being here with us. We always enjoy doing this very much. It's unfortunate that a lot of our schedules conflict to the point where sometimes only two of us can come at a time. And we're working on getting everybody together. And thank you, Andrew, for showing up tonight.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just like you said, I enjoy being here, and I think that regardless if we have two, if we've got three, if we've got five, I think the one mega episode that we've done where I think we had almost, what, six people on one podcast, I think that there is so much material that we can cover that our wellspring is never going to run dry. So definitely enjoy doing this, and for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everybody here at the Fourth Age Podcast, Sarabi Minto, Manshima, Daishite.
Good night, everybody. Thanks. Thank you.